Separating the policy from the politics, delving deeper into what is happening in our world today, and sharing the information you may not know if you didn't listen to this show. iHub Radio presents The Lovable Liberal. This is the Anita Rufus Show, civil discourse on current events and politics. Here's Anita.
So it's April Fool's Day, and I'm going to call for a tow on my car because some weird thing happened on the freeway, which I hope is just a joke that somebody was trying to play on me. I hope you have a good day. You know, stuff happens. Life is like that. My life has really been going along pretty well, and the fact that I'm fully vaccinated. I went out to dinner with some other fully vaccinated friends last night, outdoors on a patio, but it almost, in fact, I proposed a toast to almost normal. And almost normal is really hard to hold on to when you are watching the George Floyd trial every day, which I have been. I'm watching almost every minute of it so that you don't have to. Because it is truly just anguish. I'm very impressed by how prepared the prosecution team is. There are so many exhibits. I think they've got exhibits going up to 500 or something. And they've been very smart about replaying the tape of what happened that day. Appropriately, they're not playing it just for the hell of it. They're playing it appropriately to support whatever the witnesses are saying and having the witnesses look at the tape. Well, of course, that means the jury's looking at the tape that many times. And evidently, according to some people who've been inside the courtroom, the jurors have been emotionally moved. When you watch the prosecutors and their questions and working from their notes, they are so prepared. They know exactly which exhibit they want to show and from what seconds to what seconds, and asking questions, sometimes having to reframe the questions because they're leading the witness, which means they're supplying the answer rather than just asking the question and letting the witness supply the answer. And it's interesting to watch some of that stuff going on. But what has been pure anguish is watching the witnesses, the people who were there at the time. Not very large crowd. There were maybe at most, I don't think they approached 20 people. And yes, they were yelling, and yes, they were trying to get the police to get off Floyd's neck, and yes, they were telling the police he can't breathe, and yes, they were saying, "What are you doing, bro? He's a human being." And when you do see, as we did originally and again through this trial, when you do see, I don't care how big he was and I don't care what he was on, George Floyd had his hands cuffed behind his back and was lying face down in the street. There were a total of 4 police officers. Don't tell me they could not control him enough to get him into the car, or to at least get him under their control without having to cause his death. The survivor's guilt is what got me yesterday. Watching people from very young witnesses in their teens, one girl who saw this happen was 9 years old. The girl who was 17 at the time and is now 18, talking about how at night she apologizes over and over again to George Floyd because she couldn't do more. These people have to live with that reality for the rest of their lives. Watching someone die and watching it with the realization that there's nothing you can do to stop it and that it is happening without real justification that you can see in the moment. pure anguish. And that survivor's guilt, which is a very real thing, you know, there have been people who survived the Holocaust who, for the rest of their lives, are traumatized that people they knew and cared about were killed and that they somehow managed not to be. It's called survivor's guilt. And watching people break down on the stand with being overwhelmed with the emotion of what they witnessed and how they feel as a result. It has been harrowing. We're not there yet. And as prepared as the prosecution is, I have been surprised at how seemingly unprepared or not as smart in their preparation that the defense has been in their cross-examination of some of these witnesses. Anyway, there are weeks of this left to go. I don't know that the TV stations that are showing it gavel to gavel will continue to do that. But when you ask yourself, can justice really happen? Can there be any justice in this situation? Nothing will bring George Floyd back. He was a human being for all his faults, as we all are. I wouldn't want every bad thing I've ever done to be brought out as a way of trying to impeach the fact that somebody killed me. I want to move on to the other reality that we are living with day to day, and that's the coronavirus. One piece of good news. New state unemployment claims fell to their lowest weekly level since the pandemic started a year ago. And the job market is showing signs of coming back to life. But meanwhile, the COVID numbers are up. What the hell is that all about? We may be on the verge of a fourth wave of this pandemic. France just shut down because they're experiencing a fourth wave. As it turns out, the most recent 7-day average of cases in the United States is just under 60,000 cases a day. 60,000 cases a day. Which is a 10% increase from the numbers we had just last week. California, I'm happy to say, is stable at the moment. And I do have some friends from Wisconsin who came out very fearful about driving across country and then coming into this environment in Southern California because at the time that they were thinking about making that trip to get away from Wisconsin for the winter, at the time they were thinking about it, California's numbers weren't looking so great. But they're both fully vaccinated and they made the drive. And my friend said to me, you know what I cannot get over is how much more cautious people are continuing to be in Southern California. No matter where you go, almost everybody is wearing a mask, even if they've been vaccinated, which is what they're supposed to do. And she did not find that to be true when she left Wisconsin. People were sick of having to do that and not thinking so much of anyone else but themselves. The numbers are up in 25 of the 50 states. Only down in 5. The biggest spikes right now are in Michigan and New York. Hospitalizations are still rising, and that is a leading edge indicator because people who have been vaccinated almost never end up in the hospital, even if they do get the virus. And it is possible to still get one of the variants, even if you've been vaccinated. But the vaccinations almost ensure that you will not end up in the hospital and you will not end up intubated and you will not end up dead. Boy, for me, that's a worthy trade, a a little bit of a sore arm and feeling tired for a couple of days compared to ending up on a ventilation machine, being intubated. Good news, 73% of seniors have been vaccinated. And the vaccines basically are working. There is some speculation that even if you get vaccinated, it is conceivable that you could still contract one of the variants. But if you did, the symptoms would be very minor. You would not end up in the hospital. You would not end up on a ventilator. You would not die. And one study that was done among 2,500 fully vaccinated people, three out of 2,500 had confirmed infections. By comparison, that was 2,500 vaccinated and only three with any infection. Compare that to almost 1,000 people who were not vaccinated, and over 160 of them did develop the infection. So those who are still hesitating to get the vaccine, get over yourself. Now, Pfizer has said that a clinical trial they've been doing shows that their vaccine was very effective in 12 to 15-year-olds. No symptomatic infections occurred among children who received that vaccine between the ages of 12 and 15. So 16 and above is now able to get the vaccination, and it looks like younger children will also be able to get vaccinated and be protected. And I was concerned this past week to see on the news that the number of children who are getting infected is rising, with some of them ending up in the hospital. So it's very important that we follow this news about the vaccine and the trials that are being done on younger people, because they need to be protected too. We're at the point where more than 550,000 people have died. More than 30 million Americans have been infected. And the number of cases per day last week was 19% lower than it is right now. But at least one-third of United States adults have received at least one vaccine shot. Makes me feel safer, and I'm still wearing a mask to go to the grocery store or the pharmacy. And the only time I don't wear one when I'm out in public is when I'm actually eating or drinking outdoors and socializing with other people who have been vaccinated. What's your story? It's time to get serious and get rid of this virus. And we don't do it by saying, I don't want my freedom to be. Get over it. Your freedom will be gone if you're on an intubator in a hospital.
She's lovable. She's liberal. And she's here to bring a tone of civility to political discussion you aren't likely to find anywhere else. The Anita Rufus Show, with your lovable liberal on iHub Radio. Here's Anita.
Okay, with regard to the virus, I want to finish up with this, because this, to me, is just the height of stupidity. You know, the Stop the Steal movement, based on the big lie about how the election was stolen from Donald Trump. Did you see, by the way, there was a wedding at Mar-a-Lago? Somebody who apparently is a member of Mar-a-Lago, the resort where Donald Trump lives in Florida, was having a wedding. And he loves to go and grab a microphone, and Trump walked into the wedding reception and grabbed the microphone and did, I don't know how many minutes, 15 minutes, 20 minutes, whatever it was, all about how the election was stolen at a wedding of people he didn't even know. He did finally, if you watch the whole piece, he did finally say something about, and I wish best wishes to the bride and groom, when he finally thought about it. But he's up there talking about how the election was stolen. Well, the group that has been trying to stop the steal is now trying to stop the vaccine. Negative reactions have been relatively rare, but any negative reactions to the vaccine are being used by many extremist groups to try and bolster a rash of false and alarmist disinformation. Some are saying COVID-19 vaccines are weapons of mass destruction and could wipe out the human race. Others say doctors and nurses giving the COVID-19 vaccine will be tried as war criminals someday. If President Biden has any challenge, it is that he's trying to reinforce trust in government as having the ability to make a difference and make people's lives better. That is what he's about. You may think he isn't all there. And given his age, the fact that he forgets names, I gave up trying to remember names a few years ago. My brain is full of too many important things to try and hold on to stuff I don't really need. But if he has any challenge that he is putting out there that he wants to fulfill, it is to make people able to trust government again, that government has a role to fulfill in making the lives of all people better. Americans first, okay, but all people. We have been an example to the world over history. And I'd like to add, there's been a controversy this past week regarding the vaccine over Dr. Deborah Birx. She was the scarf lady who was part of the Trump virus task force that was headed by Vice President Mike Pence. And she was usually right up there along with Dr. Anthony Fauci when Donald Trump was trying to take over the COVID press conferences. Deborah Birx coordinated the White House coronavirus task force. And she has said this past week, now that she's no longer in the administration, she has said that she believes that the COVID-19 death rate in the U.S. would have been substantially lower if Trump's government had responded more effectively. She says there were about 100,000 deaths that came from that first original surge. And then she went on to say all of the rest of them were at 550,000 plus. She's saying all of the rest of them, 450,000 additional deaths, could have been mitigated or decreased substantially. And there were those of us who were saying that at the time. President Trump had downplayed the outbreak in its early stages. He resisted a lot of the mitigation efforts. He criticized the harsh lockdown measures that were being taken in states. He poo-pooed and eschewed the idea of wearing a mask. I still remember laughing out loud when he said, "Well, I can't wear a mask. You know, I meet all these foreign dignitaries and foreign what did he call them? Foreign tyrants or anyway, it was that concept of, you know, he meets with all these foreign people. Some of them are tyrants and despots, and he can't meet them with a mask on." God. When you look at Donald Trump, I have to say, as a woman, I think he looked better with a mask on. Anyway. The question is, should Dr. Birx have spoken out at the time? and run the risk of being fired and pushed out of the organization? Or was it appropriate for her to stay there and try and have an influence from inside? This is an argument that we've been having for a long time. During the feminist movement in the 60s, the question was, should we be fighting from outside, or did we need to get inside and try and make the changes from within the system, which can be almost impossible? But then, if you're not inside the system, how can you actually have any real impact? Well, ask Dr. Martin Luther King about that. This is Anita Rufus, the lovable liberal. You are listening to iHub Radio. I'm here live on Thursday afternoons from 1 to 3. You can get reruns of the show on the weekends, and you can always find podcasts.
In a land so divided, she's a uniter, not a divider. This is the Anita Rufus Show, featuring the lovable liberal on iHub Radio. Here's Anita.
And thank you so much for joining me. This is Anita Rufus, the lovable liberal. I appreciate you being here on iHub Radio. I want to switch to voting rights. We've been hearing a lot about that in the recent past, and that's because Georgia, among other states, Georgia rushed through some changes in voting. They're claiming that these changes actually make it better for voters. Well, I guess that depends on which voters you are. Republican-controlled states, where Republicans control the state legislature, the state house, the state senate, especially in states where the governor is of the opposite party. So you have a Democratic governor with a Republican legislature. Now, in some states, like Wisconsin, that legislature has literally taken away the powers of the governor that traditionally the governor always had, because they don't want that Democratic governor to be able to do things that thwart what the Republican legislature is trying to accomplish. And so in some ways, you have this situation which I call the tyranny of the minority. Because the truth is, well, let me just give you a little statistic. The states that went strongly for President Biden produce, are you sitting down? Those states that went for Biden produce 79% of the gross domestic product in this country. The states that went strongly for Donald Trump produce only 21% of the gross domestic product. Now, that doesn't mean the people in those states don't work hard, and it doesn't mean that they don't matter. Of course they do. But when I talk about the tyranny of the minority, you know, if Republicans are really concerned about getting enough votes because they lost, and especially they had to swallow the loss of those two Senate seats, which, by the way, if you go back and look at what happened during that campaign, if Donald Trump had kept his mouth shut, the two Republicans might have won that race. But the Republicans are so upset at having lost that they're putting in place, or trying to put in place, it's already going into the courts, but they're trying to put in place provisions that make it more difficult to vote, especially if you live in certain areas. They want to take control of state elections away from the secretaries of state. Gee, I wonder where they got that idea. Oh, yeah. In Georgia, in spite of the president for an hour haranguing the Secretary of State, the elected Secretary of State of Georgia, Mr. Raffensperger, Trump for an hour on the phone harangued Raffensperger to find the votes he needed to turn around the result of the election in Georgia. So now the Georgia legislature and other states are proposing much the same. They want to take away control of elections from the office of the Secretary of State or from governors or even from nonpartisan election boards in the counties. They want, I'm not kidding about this, this has also been proposed in Arizona. They want the state legislature to be able to overrule election results if they think that maybe those election results aren't what they expected them to be. If they think there was something wrong, there must have been something wrong if that guy could win that election. And what they want is to take away the ability to certify an election from the Secretary of State's office and even from nonpartisan election boards. Now, what does that mean? Well, it means that if you have a Republican legislature in your state and your state decides to vote for the Democratic presidential candidate, they can overrule that and say the election wasn't fair, and they can direct that the electoral votes go to the person who didn't win. How any of this will survive the courts, I have no idea. But one of the provisions in Georgia, for example, it says absentee voters, people who want to vote by mail, will be required to submit driver's license numbers or other documentation that is set forth by the state legislature. Well, it turns out that over 200,000 legitimate voters in Georgia don't have a driver's license. And some people, not just in Georgia, but throughout the country, they live far enough out in the countryside. It's not easy for them to get to a place where they can get that document that you most often have to pay for a photo ID. Now, Republican lawmakers said that these measures are going to increase trust in election results because so many people are concerned about the claims of fraud in the 2020 election. Gee, who are the people who were telling us we shouldn't trust the results? Oh, yeah, those same people who are now passing those laws. Now, this tyranny of the minority also exists on the gun laws. And just yesterday here in Orange, California, I used to live in the town of Orange. Just yesterday, again, a mass shooting, 4 people. A couple people ended up in the hospital, including the shooter. But here's an interesting reality about gun laws. California and New York are the first and fourth largest population states. Between the two states, they have about 18% of the United States population. But they only have 4% of the senators, because we have 2 senators from each state. As far back as the 20s and 30s, even the National Rifle Association used to favor tighter gun laws. And as recently as the 1960s, the NRA supported some limits on guns, who could have them and what kind. But in 1977, there was literally a coup inside the NRA that put a lot of the hardliners in charge. And even though they are now facing bankruptcy and have had some very specious internal machinations going on by those in power, we nevertheless have a gun culture that is focused on handguns, on assault weapons, and on paranoia about those other people. Universal background checks ought to be required for any sale in any way or any transfer of a gun from one person to another. I may have mentioned this on the air last week. The fact that you have a gun and you don't use it anymore, or you want to get it out of the house because you have young children, so you decide you're going to give the gun to your cousin who just took up hunting and liked your gun, you should still have to do a background check on your cousin. You don't know what your cousin may do in his private life. We need universal background checks for any gun sale online, at a gun show. And I don't know if you're aware of these ghost guns. People can make guns based on those sophisticated copying machines that kick out pieces of plastic that can be assembled. And those are guns that can't even be detected when they're in a piece of luggage. We should have red flag laws so that families or domestic partners who have been victims of violence can let officials know and get guns out of the hands of people who might be tempted to use them just because they have them and who are a danger to others or to themselves. One of the biggest, in fact, I think it is the biggest statistic of people who are killed by handguns is suicides. And that's why we need a waiting period, a cooling off period, at least 3 days, if not 10, to do full background checks and to give people time to just let it settle if they had a bad impulse. The truth is, this country has way too many guns. We have more than 400 million firearms in the hands of Americans. Now, kids having access to guns. Some of the stories I read just this week are harrowing. The 11-year-old who knew where Dad's gun safe was and knew that Dad kept a key on top of the gun safe, and Dad had always made the kid comfortable around firearms and taught him how to shoot and taught him the importance of being safe. One night, this 11-year-old told his folks he was going into their room to watch the other TV because he wanted to watch cartoons, and decided to get the gun, handgun, out of Dad's gun safe because he knew where the gun safe was and he knew where the keys were. And he shot himself, put the gun to his temple, and shot himself. 11. Beside the anguish of those parents at having lost that child, which I can't even imagine the horror of that. Shouldn't Dad have to pay some kind of a penalty for having made that gun even remotely accessible and loaded to that 11-year-old kid? Every day in this country, children handle guns they're not supposed to touch. And every day they hurt people with them, themselves. Kids younger than 2 years old have been able to get hold of a gun and kill a sibling. Older children shoot their friends, their parents, their neighbors, their classmates, and far, far too often they kill themselves. And yet after now 3 mass shootings have fueled this push for universal background checks and an assault weapons ban, very few of our political leaders are leading the fight on this to protect children from being able to access deadly weapons. A 2019 poll showed that 8 in 10 people in the U.S., including 70% of Republicans, support legislation mandating that guns be properly locked up and unloaded when they are not in use. You want to say this is all about mental illness? Fine, then let's have a medical system where we make sure that gets addressed. This is Anita Rufus, the lovable liberal, and the anguish of today between the trial going on right now about the death of George Floyd and the cases I see of children killing. It's just horrifying.
The Lovable Liberal continues now on iHub Radio. Here's Anita Rufus.
Now, just to remind you, I am also not just the lovable liberal. I am also the fabulous feminist. And yesterday was the last day of Women's History Month. And I just want to hit a few final things about women in particular that I think we need to at least internalize as we leave Women's History Month. In February of 2020, a little over a year ago, the women in the United States hit a real milestone. This is right after Joe Biden was inaugurated and after the 4 years of the Trump administration. For the first time in history, in February of 2020, women held the majority of non-farm payroll jobs, outnumbering men in the workforce. 1 year later, women's labor participation is at a 33-year low. This is one of the reasons why it is so important that Joe Biden is proposing childcare in this country, because putting mothers back to work is so vital to the health of the economy and to the children. Now, this past Wednesday, last week, was Equal Pay Day. You know what that means? That's the day this year that women, white women anyway, that women on average finally reached the point of earnings that men reached as of December 31st of last year. And while we're debating raising the federal minimum wage, I want to talk for a minute about women who work for tips. Tipped female workers right now are being crushed, both financially and emotionally. Many of them have kids. What are they supposed to do with their kids while they're working? And over two-thirds of the 5 million tip workers in America are women. Now, I want to say that again. Over two-thirds of the 5 million tip workers in America are women. And they can potentially, not all of them are, some employers are more generous, but they can potentially be paid at a minimum cash wage, or something that's known as the sub-minimum wage, of $2.13 an hour, because it's presumed they're going to be making tips. Well, I just want to suggest to you, for example, if you work in a restaurant for tips and the restaurant's just not very busy, how are you supposed to live on $2.13 an hour, sub-minimum wage? Or what if a lot of the people who come into your restaurant are pikers, or they don't like the fact that you're an Asian waitress or a black waiter working for tips, and so they just don't tip you much? Or let's say it is presumed that a certain percentage of the earnings of the restaurant, a certain percentage of those earnings is tip money, which then gets split, perhaps appropriately so, between the workers behind the counter in the kitchen and the people who wait on tables. Nevertheless, sub-minimum wage of $2.13 an hour. No wonder we end up with a lot of white people who don't even know what they're doing. Because otherwise, why would anyone take those jobs? Now, I heard something on talk radio last week that absolutely blew my mind and infuriated me. I'm not going to give his name, but he is on a Fox News Network talk show on radio. that Fox has a radio station. And he is also someone who does appear on Fox News on TV. And he's got this talk show on radio. And I listen to some of those things so you don't have to. You're welcome. Dr. Rachel Levine is the name of the new Assistant Secretary for Health in the Department of Health and Human Services. She is also the first transgender person to have ever been confirmed by the Senate for a federal position. At least an out transgender, we don't know. There may have been others who just were so good at hiding it that nobody knew. But this is the first acknowledged transgender woman. She's a doctor, a pediatrician. She's the former health secretary of Pennsylvania. And this, I want to describe him in a way that I really shouldn't say on radio. This person on talk radio, this Fox guy, was talking about her. And the first thing he said was how ghastly this woman is in terms of her beauty. She's a truly unattractive woman. But he didn't call her a woman. He called her an it. He actually said this it, and all you have to do is look at her. It was disgusting. This is a human being. You may not approve of the choices she's had to make in her life to be who she is, but she is a person. She is not an it. And attractive? That guy ought to look in the mirror. Now in Michigan, the Republican Party leader, you know that Governor Gretchen Whitmer is the one who armed right-wingers who wanted their freedom when the state was being locked down and masks were required, invaded the state house. And she's the governor who a small group of nuts tried to kidnap, and they were going to even kill her. How dare she take away their freedoms? And by the way, the numbers in Michigan are up for the virus. In any event, the leader of the Republican Party in the state of Michigan has publicly called Governor Whitmer a witch and says that Republicans who voted to impeach Trump may need assassination. This is the head of the Republican Party in a major American state. Someone in the crowd asked about witches in our own party. What about witches in our own party? And he said, ma'am, other than assassination, I have no other way than voting them out. Like assassination is a choice? We need to get this Violence Against Women Act reauthorized, and we need to recognize that the status of women in the United States has not yet reached a state that we should feel proud of, let alone hold ourselves out to the world as an example of how everybody else ought to be. This is Anita Rufus, the lovable liberal. When we come back, Biden's agenda, ambitious as hell.